The Nashes were a loyal couple, like-minded. John Forbes Nash, Jr. was born almost exactly 4 years after his parents' marriage, on June 13, 1928. He first saw the light of day not at home, but in the Bluefield Sanitarium, a small hospital on Ramsey Street that has long since been converted to other uses. Other than that single fact, again suggestive of the Nash's comfortable circumstances, nothing is now known of his coming into the world. Did Virginia catch influenza during her winter pregnancy? Were there any other complications? Were forceps needed during the delivery? While viral exposure in utero or a subtle birth injury might have played a role in his later mental illness, there is no available record or memory to suggest any such trauma. No anesthesia was required during the delivery, Virginia later told her daughter. The 7-pound baby boy was, as far as anyone still living remembers, apparently healthy, and was soon baptized in the Episcopal Church directly opposite the Martin House on Tazewell Street, and given his father's full name. Everyone, however, called him Johnny. He was a singular little boy, solitary and introverted. The once dominant view of the origins of the schizoid temperament was that abuse, neglect, or abandonment caused the child to give up the possibility of gratification from human relationships at a very early age. Johnny Nash certainly did not fit this now discredited paradigm. His parents, especially his mother, were actively loving. In general, one can imagine, on evidence from biographies of many brilliant men who were peculiar and isolated as children, that an inward-looking child might react to intrusive adults by withdrawing further into his own private world, or that efforts to make him conform might be met by firm resolve to do things his own way, or perhaps that unsympathetic taunting peers might have a similar effect. But the facts of Nash's childhood, in many ways so typical of the educated classes in small American towns of that era, suggest that his temperament may well have been one that he was born with. As the vivid memory of his grandmother's piano playing suggests, Johnny Nash's infancy was spent a good deal in the company not only of his adoring mother, but also of his grandmother, aunts, and young cousins. The Highland Street house to which the Nashes had moved, shortly after his birth, was within walking distance of Tazewell Street, and Virginia continued to spend a great deal of time there, even after the birth of Johnny's younger sister Martha in 1930. But by the time Johnny was 7 or 8, his parents had come to consider him bookish and slightly odd. While Martha and her cousins rode stick horses, cut paper dolls out of old pattern books, and played house and hide-and-seek in the almost scary but nice attic, Johnny could always be found in the parlor with his nose buried in a book or a magazine. At home, despite his mother's urgings, he ignored the neighborhood children, preferring to stay indoors alone. His sister spent most of her free time at the pool, or playing football and kickball, or taking part in crabapple battles with long, flimsy sticks. But Johnny played by himself, with toy airplanes and cars. Although he was no prodigy, Johnny was a bright and curious child. His mother, with whom he was always closest, responded by making his education a principal focus of her considerable energy. Mother was a natural teacher, Martha observes. She liked to read, she liked to teach. She wasn't just a housewife. Virginia, who became actively involved in the PTA, taught Johnny to read by age 4, sent him to a private kindergarten, saw to it that he skipped half a grade early in elementary school, tutored him at home, and later on in high school had him enroll at Bluefield College to take courses in English, science, and math. John Sr.'s hand in his son's education was less visible. More distant than Virginia, he nonetheless shared his interests with his children, taking Johnny and Martha on Sunday drives to inspect power lines, for example, and more important, supplied answers to his son's incessant questions about electricity, geology, weather, astronomy, and other technological subjects and the natural world. A neighbor remembers that John Sr. always spoke to his children as if they were adults. He never gave Johnny a coloring book, he gave him science books. At school, Johnny's immaturity and social awkwardness were initially more apparent than any special intellectual gifts. His teachers labeled him an underachiever, He daydreamed or talked incessantly, and had trouble following directions, a source of some conflict between him and his mother. His fourth-grade report card, in which music and mathematics were his lowest marks, contained a note to the effect that Johnny needed improvement in effort, study habits, and respect for the rules. He gripped his pencil like a stick. His handwriting was atrocious, and he was somewhat inclined to use his left hand. John Sr. insisted he write only with his right hand. Virginia eventually made him enroll in a penmanship course at a local secretarial college where he learned a certain style of printing, and also how to type. A newspaper clipping from Virginia's scrapbook shows him sitting in a classroom with rows and rows of teenage girls, his eyes rolled up in his head, looking stupefyingly bored. Complaints about his writing, his talking out of turn, or even monopolizing the class discussion, and his sloppiness dogged him right through the end of high school. His best friends were books, and he was always happiest learning on his own. Nash alludes to his preference obliquely in his autobiographical essay. My parents provided an encyclopedia, Compton's Pictured Encyclopedia, that I learned a lot from by reading it as a child. And also there were other books available from either our house or the house of the grandparents that were of educational value. And the best time of day was after dinner every evening, when John Sr. would sit at his desk in the small family room off the living room, the size of a sleeping porch, and John Jr. could sprawl in front of the radio, listening to classical music or news reports, or reading either the encyclopedia or the family's stacks of well-worn Life and Time magazines, and ask his father questions. His great passion was experimenting. By the time he was 12 or so, he had turned his room into a laboratory. He tinkered with radios, fooled around with electrical gadgets, and did chemistry experiments. A neighbor recalls Johnny rigging the Nash telephone to ring with the receiver off. Though he had no close companions, he enjoyed performing in front of other children. At one point, he would hold on to a big magnet that was wired with electricity to show how much current he could endure without flinching. Another time, he'd read about an old Indian method of making oneself immune to poison ivy. He wrapped poison ivy leaves in some other leaves and swallowed them whole in front of a couple of other boys. One afternoon, he went to a carnival that had come to Bluefield. The crowd of children he was with clustered around a sideshow. There was a man sitting in an electric chair, holding swords in each of his hands. Sparks flashed and danced between the two tips. He challenged anyone in the crowd to do the same. Johnny Nash, then about 12, stepped forward and grabbed the swords and repeated the man's trick. "There's nothing to it," he said as he rejoined the others. "How did you do that?" asked one of the children. "Static electricity," answered Nash, before launching into a more detailed explanation. Johnny's lack of interest in childish pursuits and lack of friends were major sources of worry for his parents. An ongoing effort to make him more well-rounded became a family obsession. Whether his apparent resolve to march to his own drummer was a question of his temperament or of his parents' concerted efforts to change his nature, the result was his withdrawal into his own private world. Martha, with whom Johnny constantly bickered, recalls, "Johnny was always different. My parents knew he was different, and they knew he was bright. He always wanted to do things his way. Mother insisted I do things for him, that I include him in my friendships. She wanted me to get him dates. She was right, but I wasn't too keen on showing off my somewhat odd brother." The Nashes pushed Johnny as hard socially as they did academically. At first it was Boy Scout camp and Sunday Bible classes. Later on, lessons at the Floyd Ward Dancing School, and membership in the John Alden Society, a youth organization devoted to improving the manners of its members. By high school, the outgoing Martha was always being enlisted to include her older brother when she socialized with friends, and in the summer holidays, the Nashes insisted that Johnny get jobs, including one at the Bluefield Daily Telegraph. In order to get him to the paper, "They got up at the wee hours of the night," Martha said. They thought it was very important in helping make him well-rounded. With a brain like John's, it seemed even more important. My mother and father didn't want him to be inside all the time with his hobbies and inventions. Johnny did not openly rebel. He dutifully trotted off to camp, dancing school, Bible classes, and later on blind dates arranged by his sister at Virginia's urging. But he did these things mainly to please his parents, especially his mother, and acquired neither friends nor social graces as a result. He continued to treat sports, going to church, the dances at the country club, visits with his cousins, all the things that so many of his peers found fascinating and enjoyable, as tedious distractions from his books and experiments. Always last to be chosen in softball, Johnny would stand in the right outfield, staring at the clouds above, eating bits of grass. Martha describes one occasion on which Virginia insisted he accompany the family to an Appalachian Power Company dinner. Johnny went, but spent the evening riding up and down in the elevator, which mesmerized him, until it broke, much to his parents' embarrassment. And on his summer jobs he found ways to entertain himself. One of Nash's classmates recalled that Nash, after disappearing for hours from his post at Bluefield Supply, was discovered rigging an elaborate system of mousetraps. At a dance, he pushed a stack of chairs onto the dance floor and danced with them rather than with a girl. Virginia kept scrapbooks chronicling her children's lives and accomplishments. In one of them is a faded and yellowed essay by one Angelo Patri, clipped from a newspaper, covered with her pen marks, underlinings, and circles, poignant hints of her hopes and fears. Queer little twists and quirks go into the making of an individual. To suppress them all and follow clock and calendar and creed until the individual is lost in the neutral gray of the host is to be less than true to our inheritance. Life, that gorgeous quality of life, is not accomplished by following another man's rules. It is true we have the same hungers and the same thirsts, but they are for different things and in different ways and in different seasons. Lay down your own day. Follow it to its noon, your own noon. Or you will sit in an outer hall listening to the chimes but never reaching high enough to strike your own. The earliest hint of Johnny's mathematical talent, ironically, was a B- in fourth-grade arithmetic. The teacher told Virginia that Johnny couldn't do the work, but it was obvious to his mother that he had merely found his own ways of solving problems. He was always looking for different ways to do things, his sister commented. More experiences like this followed, especially in high school, when he often succeeded in showing, after a teacher had struggled to produce a laborious, lengthy proof, that the proof could be accomplished in two or three elegant steps. There is no sign of a mathematical pedigree in Nash's ancestry or any indication that mathematics was much in the air at the Nash household. Virginia Nash was literary, and for all his interest in contemporary developments in science and technology, John Sr. was not well versed in abstract mathematics. Nash does not recall ever discussing his later research with his father. Martha's recollection of dinner table discussions were that they revolved around the meaning of words, books the children were reading, and current events. The first bite of the mathematical apple probably occurred when Nash, at around age 13 or 14, read E.T. Bell's extraordinary book, Men of Mathematics, an experience he alludes to in his autobiographical essay. Bell's book, which was published in 1937, would have given Nash the first glimpse of real mathematics, a heady realm of symbols and mysteries entirely unconnected to the seemingly arbitrary and dull rules of arithmetic and geometry taught in school, or even to the entertaining but ultimately trivial calculations that Nash carried out in the course of chemistry and electrical experiments. Men of Mathematics consists of lively, and as it turns out not entirely accurate, biographical sketches. Its flamboyant author, a professor of mathematics at the California Institute of Technology, declared himself disgusted with the ludicrous untruth of the traditional portrait of the mathematician as a slovenly dreamer, totally devoid of common sense. He assured his readers that the great mathematicians of history were an exceptionally virile and even adventuresome breed. He sought to prove his point with vivid accounts of infant precocity, monstrously insensitive educational authorities, crushing poverty, jealous rivals, love affairs, royal patronage, and many varieties of early death, including some resulting from duels. He even went so far in defending mathematicians as to answer the question, how many of the great mathematicians have been perverts? None, was his answer. Some lived celibate lives, usually on account of economic disabilities, but the majority were happily married. The only mathematician discussed here whose life might offer something of interest to a Freudian is Pascal. The book became a bestseller as soon as it appeared. What makes Bell's account not merely charming but intellectually seductive are his lively descriptions of mathematical problems that inspired his subjects when they were young, and his breezy assurance that there were still deep and beautiful problems that could be solved by amateurs, boys of 14, to be specific. It was Bell's essay on Fermat, one of the greatest mathematicians of all time, but a perfectly conventional 17th-century French magistrate whose life was quiet, laborious, and uneventful, that caught Nash's eye. The main interest of Fermat, who shares the credit for inventing calculus with Newton and analytical geometry with Descartes, was number theory, the higher arithmetic. Number theory investigates the mutual relationships of those common whole numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which we utter almost as soon as we learn to talk. For Nash, proving a theorem known as Fermat's theorem about prime numbers, those mysterious integers that have no divisor besides themselves and one, produced an epiphany of sorts. Other mathematical geniuses, Einstein and Bertrand Russell among them, recount similarly revelatory experiences in early adolescence. Einstein recalled the wonder of his first encounter with Euclid at age 12. Here were assertions, as for example the intersection of three altitudes of a triangle at one point, which, though by no means evident, could nevertheless be proved with such certainty that any doubt appeared to be out of the question. This lucidity and certainty made an indescribable impression on me. Nash does not describe his feelings when he succeeded in devising a proof for Fermat's assertion that if n is any whole number and p any prime, then n multiplied by itself p times minus n is divisible by p. But he notes the fact in his autobiographical essay, and his emphasis on this concrete result of his initial encounter with Fermat suggests that the thrill of discovering and exercising his own intellectual powers, as much as any sense of wonder inspired by hitherto unsuspected patterns and meanings, was what made this moment such a memorable one. That thrill has been decisive for many a future mathematician. Bell describes how success in solving a problem posed by Fermat led Carl Friedrich Gauss, the renowned German mathematician, to choose between two careers for which he was similarly talented. It was this discovery which induced the young man to choose mathematics instead of philology as his life work. However heady it may have been to prove a theorem of Fermat's, the experience was hardly enough to plant the notion in Nash's mind that he might himself become a mathematician. Although as a high school student, Nash took mathematics at Bluefield College as late as his senior year, when he already had gone much further into number theory, he still had firmly in mind following in his father's footsteps and becoming an electrical engineer. It was only after he had entered Carnegie Tech, with enough math to skip most entry-level courses, that his professors would convince him mathematics, for a chosen few, was a realistic choice as a profession. The Japanese attack on the Pearl Harbor Naval Base in Hawaii on December 7, 1941, came halfway through Johnny's first year in high school. A few days later, Johnny and Mop, as he called his younger sister, got a lesson from their father in how to shoot a .22-caliber rifle. He drove them up to a ridge where the power lines cut a wide swath through the scrubby, snow-dusted pine wood. Pointing toward the town below, huddling under a sooty gray cloud, he told them, in the soft, formal way he had of addressing his children, that the Japanese wouldn't rest until they had reached their West Virginia hometown, remote and surrounded by mountains as it was, because blowing up the coal trains was the only way they could cripple the mighty American war machine. A 22, he said, was only a squirrel gun. You couldn't even kill a deer or a bear with one, but it was easier than a heavier gun for women and children to handle. They had no choice, really. The Japanese wouldn't be satisfied with destroying trains. They'd raise the city, round up all the men, murder all the civilians, even schoolchildren like them. If you could shoot this thing, you might be able to stop someone who was coming after you long enough to run away and hide someplace until the army rescued you. Years later, when Johnny Nash saw secret signs of invaders everywhere and believed that he and only he could keep the universe safe, he would be sick with anxiety, shaking and sweating and sleepless for hours and days at a time. But on that bright December afternoon, he was excited and happy as he fingered the rifle. The war came thundering through Bluefield, West Virginia, in the roaring, rattling shapes of freight car after car heaped high with coal from the great Pocahontas coal field in the mountains to the west. 40% of all the coal fueling the war machine. And troop trains crowded with sailors and soldiers, round-faced farm boys from Iowa and Indiana, and edgy factory hands from Pittsburgh and Chicago. The war shook and rattled the city out of its depression slumber, filling its warehouses and streets, making overnight fortunes for scrap speculators and wheeler dealers of all kinds. Workers were suddenly in short supply, and there were jobs for everybody who wanted them. Bluefield teenagers hung around the train station watching it all, attended war bond rallies, Greer Garson showed up at one, and in school took part in tin can drives and bought war bonds with books of 10-cent stamps they bought in school. The war made a lot of Bluefield boys want to hurry and grow up, lest the war be over before they were eligible to join. But Johnny didn't feel that way, his sister recalled. He did become obsessed with inventing secret codes, consisting, as one former schoolmate recalled, of weird little animal and people hieroglyphics, sometimes adorned with biblical phrases. Though the wealthy be great, roll in splendor and state, I envy them not, I declare it. Adolescence wasn't easy for an intellectually precocious boy with few social skills or athletic interests to help him blend in with his small-town peers. The boys and girls on Country Club Hill let him tag along when they went hiking in the woods, explored caves, and hunted bats. But they found him, his speech, his behavior, the knapsack he insisted on carrying, weird. He was teased more than average simply because he was so far out. Donald V. Reynolds, who lived across the street from the Nashes, said, "What he thought of as experimenting, we thought of as crazy. We called him Big Brains." Once some boys in the neighborhood tricked him into a boxing match, and he took a beating. But because he was tall, strong, and physically courageous, the teasing only rarely degenerated into outright bullying. He rarely passed up a chance to prove that he was smarter, stronger, braver. Boredom and simmering adolescent aggression led him to play pranks, occasionally ones with a nasty edge. He caricatured classmates he disliked with weird little cartoons. He later told a fellow mathematician at MIT that, as a youngster, he had sometimes enjoyed torturing animals. He once constructed a Tinker Toy rocking chair, wired it electrically, and tried to get Martha to sit in it. He played a similar prank on a neighboring child. Nelson Walker, head of Bluefield's Chamber of Commerce, told a newspaper reporter the following story. "I was a couple of years younger than Johnny. One day I was walking by his house on Country Club Hill, and he was sitting on the front steps. He called for me to come over and touch his hands. I walked over to him, and when I touched his hands, I got the biggest shock I'd ever gotten in my life. He'd somehow rigged up batteries and wires behind him so that he wouldn't get shocked, but when I touched his hands, I got the living fire shocked out of me. After that, he just smiled, and I went on my way." Occasionally, the pranks got him into hot water. One incident involving a small explosion in the high school chemistry lab landed him in the principal's office. Another time, he and some other boys were picked up by the police for a curfew violation. When he was 15, Nash and a couple of boys from across the street, Donald Reynolds and Herman Kirchner, began fooling around with homemade explosives. They gathered in Kirchner's basement, which they called their laboratory, where they made pipe bombs and manufactured their own gunpowder. They constructed cannons out of pipe and shot stuff through them. Once they managed to shoot a candle through a thick wooden board. One day, Nash showed up at the lab holding a beaker. "I've just made some nitroglycerin," he announced excitedly. Donald didn't believe him. He told him to go down to Crystal Rock and throw it over the cliff to see what would happen. Nash did just that. "Luckily," said Reynolds, "it didn't work. He would have blown off the whole side of the mountain." The bomb-making came to a horrifying end one afternoon in January 1944. Herman Kirchner, who was alone at the time, was building yet another pipe bomb when it exploded in his lap, severing an artery. He bled to death in the ambulance that came for him. Donald Reynolds's parents packed him off to boarding school the following fall. For Nash, whose parents may or may not have known the extent of his involvement in the bomb-making, it was a sobering experience that brought home the dangers of his experiments. He had grown up essentially without ever making a close friend. Just as he learned to deflect his parents' criticism of his behavior with his intellectual achievements, he learned to armor himself against rejection by adopting a hard shell of indifference and using his superior intelligence to strike back. Julia Robinson, the first woman to become president of the American Mathematical Society, said in her autobiography that she believed that many mathematicians felt themselves to be ugly ducklings as children, unlovable and out of kilter with their more conventional, conforming peers. Johnny's apparent sense of superiority, his standoffishness, and his occasional cruelty were ways of coping with uncertainty and loneliness. What he lost by his lack of genuine interaction with children his own age was a lively sense, in reality, of his actual position in the human hierarchy that prevents other children with more social contact from feeling either unrealistically weak or unrealistically powerful. If he could not believe he was lovable, then feeling powerful was a good substitute. As long as he could be successful, his self-esteem could remain intact. Johnny chose the time-honored escape route from the confines of small-town life. He performed well in school. With Virginia's encouragement, he took courses at Bluefield College. He read voraciously, mostly futuristic fantasy books, popular science magazines, and real science texts. He was just an outstanding problem solver, his high school chemistry teacher later told the Bluefield Daily Telegraph. "When I put a chemistry problem up on the blackboard, all the students would get out a pencil and a piece of paper. John wouldn't move. He would stare at the formula on the board, then stand up politely and tell us the answer. He could do it all in his head. He never even took out a pencil or a piece of paper." This youthful Gedanken experimentation actually helped shape the way he approached mathematical problems later on. His peers became more respectful. At a time when the war was making heroes out of scientists, Johnny's classmates assumed he was slated to become one. In high school, Nash became friendly, though not close friends, with a couple of fellow students, John Williams and John Louthan, both sons of Bluefield College professors. The three rode a public bus to school together, and Johnny helped Williams with Latin translations. Williams recalled, "We were attracted to him. He was an interesting guy." That was sort of it. I don't think we ever went over to John's house. It was pretty much of a school thing. The three also constantly maneuvered to get out of their classes as much as possible. Before the widespread use of the SATs, college recruiters routinely came to the high school and would invite students to take their admissions tests. "We spent many mornings taking those tests," Williams said. At the beginning of the year, at Johnny's instigation, they made a bet, no one remembers for how much, that they could make the honor roll without ever cracking a book. All three thought they were pretty smart, but at the same time were contemptuous of grinds and teacher's pets. "We kind of got drug into it by Nash," Williams said. Nash, who was already taking a full load of courses at Bluefield College, never made the Honor Society, missing it by a few tenths of a percent. The other two did, though by a hair. John Sr. suggested that Johnny apply to West Point, a suggestion that once again may have reflected the father's anxiety that his son was not growing up well-rounded as much as it did the prospect of free college tuition. But, as Martha said, even I could see that wouldn't have worked. Whatever fantasies he may have had about becoming a scientist, when asked to describe his career aspirations in an essay, Johnny wrote that he hoped to become an engineer like his father. He and John Sr. wrote an article together describing an improved method for calculating the proper tensions for electric cables and wires, a project that entailed weeks of field measurements, and published the results jointly in an engineering journal. Johnny entered the George Westinghouse competition and won a full scholarship, 1 out of 10 that were awarded nationally. The fact that Lloyd Shapley, a son of the famous Harvard astronomer Harlow Shapley, also won a Westinghouse that year, made the achievement all the sweeter in the eyes of the Nash family. Johnny was accepted at the Carnegie Institute of Technology. Because of the war, all colleges were on accelerated schedules and operated year-round so that students could graduate in 3 years. Johnny left Bluefield for Pittsburgh, taking a train from nearby Hinton in mid-June, a few weeks before the VE Day parade celebrating Hitler's defeat. Chapter 2. Carnegie Institute of Technology, June 1945 to June 1948. In those days, very few people became mathematicians. It was like becoming a concert pianist. Raoul Bott, 1995. Nash went to Pittsburgh to become a chemical engineer, but his growing interest was in mathematics. It was not long before he abandoned the laboratory and slide rule for Möbius knots and Diophantine equations. With its smelters, power plants, polluted rivers, and ubiquitous slag heaps, Pittsburgh was a city of violent strikes and frequent floods. So dense was the sulfurous haze that engulfed its downtown that travelers arriving by rail often mistook morning for midnight. The Carnegie Institute of Technology, perched halfway up Squirrel Hill, hardly escaped the inferno. The ivory-colored brick of its buildings, designed, or so students said, to serve as factories should Andrew Carnegie's school fail, were glazed yellow-black. Its walkways were gritty with soot particles the size of pebbles. Its students were forced, before a lecture was half over, to brush the cinders from their lecture notes. Even at high noon in midsummer, one could stare directly at the sun without blinking. In that era, Carnegie was shunned by the local ruling elite, which sent its children east to Harvard and Princeton. Richard Syert, who joined the Carnegie faculty after the war and would later become its president, recalled, "When I came, this place was really very backward." The engineering school, with its 2,000 or so students, still resembled the trade school for sons and daughters of electricians and bricklayers that it had been at the turn of the century. But like so many other colleges right after the war, Carnegie was changing. Robert Daugherty, its president, had seized the opportunities created by wartime research to turn the engineering school into a real university. He parlayed defense contracts and the prospect of ballooning enrollments into a big push to recruit brilliant young researchers in math, physics, and economics. "The theoretical sciences were being pushed very hard," recalled Richard Duffin, a mathematician. Daugherty was trying to take CT into the big time. Corporate giants like Westinghouse, whose headquarters were in Pittsburgh, supplied generous scholarships to lure talented young people to Carnegie. Among the scholarship recipients who entered Carnegie in 1945 were talented youngsters like Andy Warhol, the artist, as well as a group of young men who would eventually, like Nash, shun engineering for science and mathematics. Nash arrived by train in June 1945. Gasoline rationing made car travel impractical. Carnegie Tech was still operating in wartime mode. Classes went year-round. Most campus activities remained canceled, and most of the fraternity houses were still shut. Within a year, the campus would be inundated with veterans, and classes would be jammed with these older students. But that June, 2 months before the war finally ended, it was mostly freshmen and sophomores who were on campus. The scholarship students were housed together in Welch Hall and took most of their classes together, small ones taught by hand-picked instructors, some of whom were first-rate. Nash took his first physics course from Immanuel Esterman, for example, a top-flight physicist who had done much of the experimental work that had netted Otto Stern, a German émigré, the 1943 Nobel Prize for Physics. Nash's engineering aspirations did not survive his first semester, killed off by an unhappy experience in mechanical drawing. "I reacted negatively to the regimentation," he later wrote. But chemistry, his newly chosen major, proved no better suited to his temperament or interests. He worked briefly as a lab assistant for one of his teachers, but got into trouble for breaking equipment. He was so bored at his summer job at the Westinghouse lab that he spent most of his 2 months there making and polishing a brass egg in the lab's machine shop. The final blow was a C in physical chemistry, which he got after a running dispute with the professor over the lack of rigor of the mathematics in the course. David Lyde recalled, "He refused to do the problems the way the professor expected." Of chemistry in general, Nash would complain, "It was not a matter of how well one could think, but of how well one could handle a pipette and perform titration in the laboratory." Even as he struggled in the laboratory, Nash was already discovering a brilliant group of newcomers to Carnegie. By his sophomore year, Doherty's program of upgrading the theoretical sciences had brought to Carnegie John Synge, nephew of the Irish playwright John Millington Synge, who became head of the mathematics department. Despite his startling appearance, Synge wore a black patch over one eye and a filter that protruded from one of his nostrils. He was a man of great charm, who attracted younger scholars like Richard Duffin, Raoul Bott, and Alexander Weinstein, a European émigré whom Einstein had once invited to become a collaborator. When Albert Tucker, a Princeton topologist who did path-breaking work in operations research, came to Carnegie to lecture that year, he was so impressed with the depth of mathematical talent at Carnegie that he confessed that he felt as if he were bringing coals to Newcastle. From the start, Nash dazzled his mathematics professors. One of them called him a young Gauss. He took courses in tensor calculus, the mathematical tool used by Einstein to formulate the general theory of relativity, and relativity from Synge. Synge was impressed with Nash's originality and his appetite for difficult problems. He and others began urging Nash to major in mathematics and to consider an academic career. Nash's doubts that one could make a living as a mathematician took some time to overcome, but by the middle of his second year, he was concentrating almost exclusively on mathematics. The Westinghouse scholarship administrators were unhappy with Nash's switch to mathematics, but by the time they learned of it, it was a fait accompli. College is a time when many ugly ducklings discover that they are swans, not just intellectually, but socially. Most of the boys in Welch Hall, precocious but immature, found common interests, kindred spirits, and a measure of acceptance painfully lacking in high school. Hans Weinberger recalled, "We were all nerds back in our high schools, and here we were able to talk to one another." Nash was not so lucky. While his professors singled him out as a potential star, his new peers found him weird and socially inept. "He was a country boy, unsophisticated even by our standards," recalled Robert Siegel, a physics major, who remembered that Nash had never attended a symphony performance before. "He behaved oddly, playing a single chord on the piano over and over, leaving an ice cream cone melting on top of his cast-off clothing in the lounge, walking on his roommate's sleeping body to turn off a light, pouting when he lost a game of bridge." Nash was rarely invited to go to concerts or restaurants with the group. Paul Zweifel, an avid bridge player, taught Nash how to play bridge, but Nash's pouting and inattention to the details of the game made him a poor partner. He wanted to talk about the theoretical aspects. Nash roomed with Weinberger for a term, but the two clashed constantly. Nash once pushed Weinberger around to end an argument, and Nash moved into a private room at the end of the hall. "He was extremely lonely," recalled Siegel. Later in life, as his accomplishments multiplied, his peers would be more apt to be forgiving. But at Carnegie, where he was thrust together with other adolescents around the clock, he became a target. He was not so much bullied. The other boys were afraid of his strength and temper. as ostracized and relentlessly teased. That he was envied for his size and his brains only fueled the teasing. He was the butt of people's jokes because he was different, recalled George Hinman, a physics student. Here was a guy who was socially underdeveloped and acting much younger. You do what you can to make his life miserable. Zweifel admitted, we tormented poor John. We were very unkind. We were obnoxious. We sensed he had a mental problem. That first summer, Nash, Paul Zweifel, and a third boy spent an afternoon exploring the subterranean maze of steam tunnels under Carnegie. In the dark, Nash suddenly turned to the others and blurted out, "Gee, if we got trapped down here, we'd have to turn homo." Zweifel, who was 15, found the remark pretty odd. But during Thanksgiving break in the deserted dormitory, Nash climbed into Zweifel's bed when the latter was sleeping and made a pass at him. Away from home, living in close proximity with other adolescents, Nash discovered that he was attracted to other boys. He spoke and acted in ways that seemed natural to him, only to find himself exposed to his peers' contempt. Zweifel and other boys in the dormitory started calling Nash homo and Nashmo. Once the statement was made, George Siegel said, it stuck. John took a lot. No doubt he found the label hurtful and humiliating, but his anger is all that anyone witnessed. The boys made him the butt of various pranks. One time Weinberger and a couple of others used a footlocker as a battering ram to break down Nash's door. Another time, Zweifel and a few others, knowing of Nash's extreme aversion to cigarette smoke, rigged up a contraption that smoked an entire pack of cigarettes and collected the smoke. A bunch of us crowded around John's door and blew the smoke under it, Zweifel recalled. Almost instantaneously, his room was filled up with cigarette smoke. Nash exploded in rage. He came roaring out of his room, picked up Jack Wachtman, and threw him down on the bed, said Zweifel. He ripped off Wachtman's shirt and bit him in the back. Then he ran out of the room. At other times, Nash defended himself the only way he knew how. He wasn't practiced in invective, sarcasm, or ridicule, so he went for childish displays of contempt. "You stupid fool," he'd say, Siegel recalled. He was openly contemptuous of people who he didn't think were up to his level intellectually. He showed that contempt for all of us. "You're an ignoramus." After a year or so, after he had acquired a reputation for being a genius, he began to hold court in Skybow Hall, the student center. Like the fairground magician with his swords, he would sit in a chair and challenge other students to throw problems at him to solve. And a lot of students came to him with their homework. He was a star, but an outcast, too. Nash stared glumly at the announcement tacked to the bulletin board outside the math department office in Administration Hall, which looked, even on the sunniest of days, like the inside of the Lincoln Tunnel. He stood in front of the board for a long time. He hadn't made it into the top five. Nash's fantasy of instant glory crumbled. The William Lowell Putnam Mathematical Competition was a prestigious national tournament for undergraduates, sponsored by an old-money Boston family known mostly for its Harvard presidents and deans. Today, the contest attracts upward of 2,000 participants. In March 1947, it was a decade old and drew about 120. But even then, it was the first chance to establish one's rank in the world of mathematics, as well as to seize the limelight. Then, as now, contestants were given a dozen problems and half an hour each to solve them. The problems were famously difficult. In any given year, the median score out of 120 possible points was zero. That meant that at least half the contestants weren't able to obtain so much as partial credit for even a single problem, and this in spite of the fact that most contestants had been chosen by their departments to compete. To have a prayer of winning, placing in the top five, a young mathematician had to be super fast or especially ingenious. The prizes involved a nominal amount of money, $20 to $40 for each of the top 10 contestants and $200 to $400 for each of the top 5 school teams. But winners became instant mini-celebrities in the mathematics world and were virtually assured a spot in a top graduate program. Different graduate programs pay more or less attention to the Putnam, but at Harvard it is, and always has been, a very, very big deal. That year, Harvard pledged a $1,500 scholarship to one of the winners. Nash had competed as a freshman and a sophomore. On his second try, he'd managed to get into the top 10, but not the top 5. He'd been cocky this time, too. In 1946, a mathematician named Moskowitz tutored the Carnegie Tech team using problems from past exams. Nash was able to solve problems that Moskowitz and the others could not solve. It was a tremendous blow to Nash that George Hinman ranked in the top 10 in the 1946 competition, and Nash didn't. Another 19-year-old might have shrugged off the disappointment, especially a boy who'd been plucked out of a chemical engineering program, welcomed with open arms by the school's mathematicians, and told that he had a brilliant future in mathematics. But for a teenager who had endured a lifetime of rejection by peers, the warm praise of such professors as Richard Duffin and J.L. Singh was too little too late. Nash craved a more universal form of recognition, recognition based on what he regarded as an objective standard, uncolored by emotion or personal ties. "He always wanted to know where he stood," said Harold Kuhn recently. "It was always important to be in the club." Decades later, after he had acquired a worldwide reputation in pure mathematics and had won a Nobel Prize in economics, Nash hinted in his Nobel autobiography that the Putnam still rankled and implied that the failure played a pivotal role in his graduate career. Today, Nash still tends to identify mathematicians by saying, "Oh, so-and-so, he won the Putnam 3 times. In the fall of 1947, Richard Duffin stood at the board, silent and frowning. He was intimately familiar with Hilbert's spaces, but he had prepared his lecture too hastily, had wandered down a cul-de-sac in the course of his proof, and was hopelessly stuck. It happened all the time. The 5 students in the advanced graduate class were getting restive. Weinberger, who was Austrian by birth, was often able to explain the fine points of von Neumann's book, Mathematische Grundlagen der Quantenmechanik, which Duffin was using as a text. But Weinberger was frowning, too. After a few moments, everybody turned toward the gawky undergraduate who was squirming in his seat. "Okay, John, you go to the board," said Duffin. "See if you can get me out of trouble." Nash leaped up and strode to the board. "He was infinitely more sophisticated than the rest of us," said Bott. "He understood the difficult points naturally. When Duffin got stuck, Nash could back him up. The rest of us didn't understand the techniques you needed in this new medium." "He always had good examples and counterexamples," another student recalled. Afterward, Nash hung around. "I could talk to Nash," Duffin recalled shortly before his death in 1995. After class one day, he started talking about Brouwer's fixed point theorem. He proved it indirectly using the principle of contradiction. That's when you show that if something's not there, something dreadful will happen. Don't know if Nash had ever heard of Brouwer. Nash took Duffin's course in his 3rd and final year at Carnegie. At 19, Nash already had the style of a mature mathematician. Duffin recalled, "He tried to reduce things to something tangible. He tried to relate things to what he knew about. He tried to get a feel for things before he actually tried them. He tried to do little problems with some numbers in them. That's how Ramanujan, who claimed he got his results from spirits, figured things out. Poincaré said he thought of a great theorem getting off a bus." Nash liked very general problems. He wasn't all that good at solving cute little puzzles. "He was a much more dreamy person," said Bott. "He'd think a long time. Sometimes you could see him thinking. Others would be sitting there with their nose in a book." Weinberger recalled that Nash knew a lot more than anybody else there. He was working on things we couldn't understand. He had a tremendous body of knowledge. He knew number theory like mad. "Diophantine equations were his love," recalled Siegel. "None of us knew anything about them, but he was working on them then." It is obvious from these anecdotes that many of Nash's lifelong interests as a mathematician, number theory, Diophantine equations, quantum mechanics, relativity, already fascinated him in his late teens. Memories differ on whether Nash learned about the theory of games at Carnegie. Nash himself does not recall. He did, however, take a course in international trade, his one and only formal course in economics, before graduating. It was in this course that Nash first began to mull over one of the basic insights that eventually led to his Nobel Prize. By the spring of 1948, in what would have been his junior year at Carnegie, Nash had been accepted by Harvard, Princeton, Chicago, and Michigan, the four top graduate mathematics programs in the country. Getting into one of these was virtually a prerequisite for eventually landing a good academic appointment. Harvard was his first choice. Nash told everyone that he believed that Harvard had the best mathematics faculty. Harvard's cachet and social status appealed to him. As a university, Harvard had a national reputation, while Chicago and Princeton, with its largely European faculty, did not. Harvard was, to his mind, simply number one, and the prospect of becoming a Harvard man seemed terribly attractive. The trouble was that Harvard was offering slightly less money than Princeton. Certain that Harvard's comparative stinginess was the consequence of his less-than-stellar performance in the Putnam competition, Nash decided that Harvard didn't really want him. He responded to the rebuff by refusing to go there. 50 years later, in his Nobel autobiography, Harvard's lukewarm attitude toward him seems still to have stung. "I had been offered fellowships to enter as a graduate student at either Harvard or Princeton, but the Princeton fellowship was somewhat more generous, since I had not actually won the Putnam competition." Princeton was eager. From the 1930s onward, Princeton had a far stronger department and was snaring the lion's share of the best graduate students. Princeton was, as a matter of fact, more selective than Harvard at that point, admitting 10 hand-picked candidates each year, as opposed to Harvard's 25 or so. The Princeton faculty didn't care a hoot about the Putnam or about tests of any kind, or grades. They paid attention exclusively to the opinions of mathematicians whose views they respected. And once Princeton decided it wanted someone, it pursued him with vigor. Duffin and Singh were pushing Princeton hard. Princeton was full of purists, topologists, algebraists, number theorists. And Duffin especially regarded Nash as someone obviously suited by interest and temperament for a career in the most abstract mathematics. "I thought he would be a completely pure mathematician," Duffin recalled. "Princeton was first in topology, that's why I wanted to send him to Princeton." The only thing Nash really knew about Princeton was that Albert Einstein and John von Neumann were there, along with a bunch of other European émigrés. But the polyglot Princeton mathematical milieu, foreign, Jewish, left-leaning, still seemed to him a distinctly inferior alternative. Sensing Nash's hesitation, Solomon Lefschetz, the chairman of the Princeton department, had already written to him, urging him to choose Princeton. He finally dangled a John S. Kennedy Fellowship. The one-year fellowship was the most prestigious the department had to offer, requiring little or no teaching, and guaranteeing a room in Princeton's residential college for graduate students. It was a sign of how much Princeton was panting for Nash. The $1,150 fellowship covered the $450 tuition, and was more than ample for the $200 room rent for a year and $14 a week in dining fees, as well as living expenses. For Nash, that clinched the decision. The difference in the awards could not have been huge in any practical sense, but then, as so many times later in Nash's life, a relatively trivial amount of money loomed in his decision. It seems clear that Nash calculated Princeton's more generous fellowship as a measure of how Princeton valued him. A personal appeal from Lefschetz, with a flattering reference to his relative youth, also proved decisive. Lefschetz's phrase, "We like to catch promising men when they are young and open-minded," struck a chord. Something else weighed on Nash's mind that last spring at Carnegie. As graduation drew closer, he became more and more worried about being drafted. He thought that the United States might go to war again, and was afraid that he might wind up in the infantry. That the army was still shrinking 3 years after the end of World War II, and that the draft had for all intents and purposes ground to a standstill, did not make Nash feel safe. The newspapers, of which he was a regular reader, were full of signs, in particular the Russian blockade of Berlin and the subsequent American-British airlift that spring, that the Cold War was heating up. He hated any thought that his personal future might be hostage to forces outside his control, and he was obsessed with ways to defend himself against any possible threats to his own autonomy or plans. So Nash was palpably relieved when Lefschetz offered to help him obtain a summer job with a Navy research project. The project, in White Oak, Maryland, was being run by Clifford Ambrose Truesdell, a former student of Lefschetz. Nash wrote to Lefschetz at the beginning of April. "Should there come a war involving the U.S., I think I should be more useful and better off working on some research project than going, say, into the infantry. Working on government-sponsored research this summer would pave the way toward the more desirable eventuality." Though Nash did not display outward signs of distress, the disappointments and anxieties of the spring cast a shadow over the summer between his graduation from Carnegie and his arrival at Princeton. White Oak is a suburb of Washington, D.C. In the summer of 1948, it was a swampy, humid woodland full of raccoons, opossums, and snakes. The mathematicians at White Oak were a hodgepodge of Americans, some of whom had been working for the Navy since the middle of the war, and others. German prisoners of war. Nash found himself a room in downtown Washington, which he rented from a Washington, D.C. police officer. He rode to White Oak in a carpool every day with two of the Germans. Nash had been looking forward to the summer. Lefschetz had promised that the work would be pure mathematics. Truesdell, quite a good mathematician, was a tolerant supervisor, who encouraged the mathematicians in his group to pursue their own research. He essentially gave Nash carte blanche, issuing no instructions and merely saying that he hoped Nash would write something before he left at the end of the summer. But Nash seemed to have trouble working. He made no apparent progress on any of the problems he had mentioned vaguely to Truesdell at the start of the summer, and he never handed in a paper. At the end of the summer, he was forced to apologize to Truesdell for having wasted his time. Nash spent most of his days, evidently, simply walking around rather aimlessly, lost in thought. Charlotte Truesdell, Truesdell's wife and the project's girl Friday, recalls that Nash seemed terribly young, like a 16-year-old, and almost never spoke to anyone. Once when she asked him what he was thinking, Nash asked whether she, Charlotte, didn't think it would be a good joke if he put live snakes in the chairs of some of the mathematicians. "He didn't do it," she said, "but he thought about it a lot." Chapter 3. The Center of the Universe. Princeton, Fall, 1948. A quaint, ceremonious village. Albert Einstein. The mathematical center of the universe. Harold Bohr. Nash arrived in Princeton, New Jersey on Labor Day, 1948, the opening day of Truman's re-election campaign. He was 20 years old. He came by train directly from Bluefield via Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, wearing a new suit and carrying unwieldy suitcases stuffed with bedding and clothes, letters and notes, and a few books. Impatient and eager now, he got off at Princeton Junction, a nondescript little middle-class enclave a few miles from Princeton proper, and hurried on to the Dinky, the small single-track train that shuttles back and forth to the university. What he saw was a genteel, pre-revolutionary village, surrounded by gently rolling woodlands, lazy streams, and a patchwork of cornfields. Settled by Quakers toward the end of the 17th century, Princeton was the site of a famous Washington victory over the British, and for a brief six-month interlude in 1783, the de facto capital of the new republic. With its college Gothic buildings, nestled among lordly trees, stone churches, and dignified old houses, the town looked every inch the wealthy, manicured exurb of New York and Philadelphia that, in fact, it was. Nassau Street, the town's sleepy main drag, featured a row of better men's clothing shops, a couple of taverns, a drugstore, and a bank. It had been paved before the war, but bicycles and pedestrians still accounted for most of the traffic. In this side of paradise, F. Scott Fitzgerald had described Princeton circa World War I as the pleasantest country club in America. Einstein called it a quaint, ceremonious village in the 1930s. Depression and wars had scarcely changed the place. May Veblen, the wife of a wealthy Princeton mathematician Oswald Veblen, could still identify by name every single family, white and black, well-to-do and of modest means, in every single house in town.